Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are honorable, whatever things are righteous, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is any praise, think on these things. As you understand, my beloved, the apostle here, as he brings his epistle to the Philippians to its close, gives a brief summary, a concise expression of Christian perfection. He wants to offer, in a few words, an outline of how his beloved Philippians ought to live and move. And he gives them this wonderful passage, which truly is an outline of Christian life and perfection. Finally, brethren, that is, what remains now? Brethren, is for me to tell you that you must always keep in your nous whatever things are true, whatever things are honorable, whatever things are righteous, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report. If there is any virtue and any praise, keep these things always in your nous. The repetition of whatever, whatever, whatever is meant precisely to emphasize each word he is about to say. And of course he emphasizes each word because every word of his has its own distinct meaning and content. But let us look at this brief saying, this brevity of perfection. Whatever things are, brothers, he says, whatever things are true, think on these things. What are the true things? First of all, the word true does not mean only those things that have to do with truth. That is, it is not simply as though he were telling them, speak the truth. It is not simply as though he were telling them to have sincerity in their relations with other people. Always to let your yes be yes and your no be no. But when he says, whatever things are true, he means it in a very general sense. Because truly all these words have a breadth to them, he means everything that is true, and not something false. You know that very many things in our life are false. For example, for someone to follow fashion, in a way that clings to it, is a false thing. It is something that is not true, and therefore, you cannot attach yourself to something that is false. Again, something true is what you work for in your life, what you believe in, what you spend your life on. You know how many people, millions of people, are working over a lie, their whole life, their profession, the money they gather, the offices, and honors they receive. All these things, you know, at some point they realize, if indeed they realize even this, that it is a lie. When Onassis was dying, he said this word in Paris, where he was being treated. Leave it aside. The miserable man, the poor man, he was alone in the clinic, alone. And he said, now I have understood that it is not enough to have a great deal of money. When did he understand it? When he no longer had any room left for anything. So, what were all those things he had labored for in his life? A lie. Have you heard people say the phrase, never mind, life is false? Have you heard it? Well then, these are people who are living what cannot endure into eternity. That is false. It is a fearful thing, my brethren, to say at the end of our life that we lived a false life. Instead, from the beginning of our life we ought to understand that what we are working for is true. When we give a cup of water in the name of Christ, this will remain into eternity. Just as true, jewels remain, because they are gold and diamonds, while false ones do not remain. They rust and are thrown away. So it is very important that we practice the truth, live the truth, and be true people in true dimensions. We must be people who love what is true. And let us not forget, what does philosophy seek to find? Truth. What does science seek to find? Truth, the truth of beings, the truth of the relations of beings, that is, truth. Then here we might say, what is truth? Briefly, I would answer, it is Christ. Whatever things are true means everything Christ said, everything Christ wills, Christ himself. Once the Lord said of Nathanael that he was a true Israelite in whom there was no deceit. That is, Nathanael never told lies. Holy Scripture says that every man is a liar. Of course, this does not only mean someone who tells lies. It also has a broader meaning, like what we are saying now, but from the opposite side. In other words, what is truth? It is something very broad, and likewise, what is a lie? That too is something very broad. Every man is a liar. Then what? Did Nathanael not tell lies? No, that was not the point. Nathanael was a sincere man in his life, one who wanted what is true. That is, what he was inwardly, he was also outwardly, and his searches were always for the truth. That is why, when Philip said to him, "We have found the Messiah," this presupposes that Nathanael and Philip were searching to find the Messiah. Where were they looking for him? In Holy Scripture. So, what were they seeking to find? What is true, they did not remain in the searches of their contemporaries and fellow countrymen, focused on material things. They were seeking the Messiah. You see, then, what a great thing it is for us to be truthful people. People who always seek what is true and not what is false. So, whatever things are true, think on these things, says the Apostle. Whatever things are modest. What is modesty? Modesty, first of all, is something judged chiefly from the outside. Because a little further down he will say whatever things are pure, and that refers to something within the person. Of course, let us not forget this. If we had to limit ourselves, without bringing in purity, which he mentions below and which we shall analyze, and speak only about modesty, the outward can never be modest if the inward is not modest. A person cannot have modest clothing when the soul is a harlot. It is not possible. The outward appearance, the way one walks, the words one speaks, all these betray what is inside. So if we had to tell someone to be modest, we would first have to tell him to be modest within. Because the inward will determine the outward. We cannot give him a recipe and say, "Look, make sure your clothes are modest." That is only a word. He will not do it. We must make him modest within. Just as the monk is not simply the one who wears the cassock. It is very easy for someone to put on the cassock. It is very easy, as the fathers say, to make the outward monk. But to make the inward monk is very difficult. You see then, that modesty begins within. Nevertheless, because he mentions here the meaning and the virtue of purity, I would like to remain only with what is outward. I have told you this before, but it does no harm to say it again. What is modesty? What is the criterion of modesty? Because what today is called modest, in a past age, and not even a very distant past age, was judged immodest. We were saying this recently too. If you go back 50 years, the clothes that modest ladies, even pious ladies, wear today were clothes that would have been considered very immodest. Then what is modest? Modesty is this. In every age you will wear, not what fashion declares at the very last moment, but also not something extremely out of date, something from a declined and bygone fashion. It is what does not draw the attention of those around you. If the other person does not turn around to look at you, it means you are dressed modestly. Because if you dress in a long tunic down to the feet, which once, of course, was a sign of modesty, will not everyone turn around to look at you? The whole world will turn to look at you, because you are wearing a long tunic, some long robe, whatever it may be. Or if you put on very outrageous things, again, people will turn and look at you. So what is modest today? It is what does not provoke. Pay attention to me. What does not provoke? And what is it that does not provoke? Where is the measure? The measure, my beloved, we have within ourselves. We have it within ourselves, therefore we must become modest people, so that we may acquire the measure of what is modest. Because if you ask someone who truly provokes, saying, "My girl, you are provoking people with the way you are dressed," she will say to you, "Why am I provoking?" And she is right, she is not lying. Why? Because she does not have the measure. In other words, it is an inward matter. When we begin to become more and more devout, then more and more, we acquire this measure of modesty. We never go to extremes with the measure of modesty. We keep the measure of our presence in this world. This is important. It is important. It is difficult. Yes, it is difficult. It is not easy. So, whatever things are modest, keep these in your mind. Whatever things are righteous. This too is a broad term, a very broad one. Toward whom will you be righteous? First of all, toward God. Is there any case in which man must be righteous toward God? Of course there is. Now, can God be wronged? It would sound absurd for anyone to say so. Is God ever wronged? And yet, he is. Within the human measure by which God laid down his law, he has rights. The law, in one of its names, out of the 10 that it bears, is also this, rights. When you do not offer God his rights, when you do not render to him what is his due, it is as though you are wronging him. You forget this. You must be just even toward God. When you are a profane person, when you are a sacrilegious person, when you steal sacred and holy things, the things that belong to God and the things that belong to the church, when you steal them, when you seize them, you wrong God, because they belong to God. When you go in and snatch the offerings from an icon and steal them, or you steal sacred money that belongs to the temple, that belongs to the church, money others have placed in the collection box, that is sacred money. If you steal them, whether you are a priest, whether you are a church trustee, whether you are the lamplighter, whether you are the chanter, whether you are a layman who opens the door, breaks open the offering box, forces the cash box, and takes the money from inside, or whether you find other respectable, looking ways to steal the money that belongs to God, then what can I say? Are you not wronging God, even though God himself cannot be wronged? For poor wretches that we are, everything belongs to God, everything belongs to him. But our actions show what we are like. They are something that marks our relationship with God. Then there is righteousness toward other people, our relationships with other people. Should I insist on this? It is self-evident. We understand what it means for someone to be righteous toward other people. It means understanding that this belongs to the other person. This is very important, and do not think it is only a matter of money. Yesterday I took a taxi so that I could complete some work for which I had gone down to Larissa. And the taxi driver said something to me that made an impression on me. He was a cultured man, a very cultured man. He told me this. I was forced, he said. I was poor and I went abroad. Abroad I learned something now. Why did he learn it abroad and not here? I find it hard to answer you. I do not know. We could suppose a few things. But what can we say? Let us not comment on it further. I learned to respect the other person, he told me, and this exactly is the rendering of righteousness. When I do not turn my radio up loudly and disturb the other person, it means I am rendering righteousness to him, because peace and quiet belong to him. When it is night, midnight, and I am singing serenades in the street, do not some people sing serenades in the street? And in Larissa, too, how many times from outside my room where I was sleeping have I heard people at 12, 1, 2, 3 in the morning, drunk, singing serenades? Gentlemen, what are you doing? What serenades are you singing at this hour? People are asleep. You are passing outside houses. People are sleeping. You wake them up. Does that not concern you? Does the quiet of these people not belong to them? You are taking their quiet from them. Since you take another man's quiet from him, you wrong him. Do you not wrong him? What can I say, my beloved? There are so many things. If you search, you will see it. And many times we go and say, in holy confession, or, worse still, we say it even to ourselves. We say, I have wronged no one. You have not wronged anyone. Where do you limit the matter of injustice? To the matter of money. To the encroaching on fields? To the scales. Where do you place this? I have wronged no one. This matter of whether I wrong or do not wrong. My neighbor has a very broad horizon, a very broad horizon. At this very moment, for example, America and Europe are wronging Africa. In the matter of hunger, they wrong them, so that you may understand, it is not simply a matter between two people, sometimes it is between two states, sometimes between two continents. When you eat well and the other man is hungry, are you not wronging him? For God gave his food for the whole world. And especially when you, the European or the American, have already exploited the Africans in the most vulgar way. You see then that the matter of injustice is very broad. But how can someone also wrong himself? Because here he says, whatever is righteous, it is also a matter of whether I wrong or do not wrong myself. This is not so self-evident, and we need to analyze it a little. What does it mean to wrong myself? In one phrase, when I send myself to hell, that is what it means to wrong myself. And how can I send myself to hell when I sin? When I sin, I wrong myself. I smoke. To take earthly realities as well, not only heavenly ones, I smoke, and I will die sooner, or I will have more illnesses than I might have had if I did not smoke. This is very well known, and it is said and repeated through every means and method of informing our people. This is extremely well known. So, you see, I smoke, I will die sooner. Am I not wronging myself? I drink, I am an alcoholic, I will die sooner. I am a lost man, a man who cannot stand upright. Am I not wronging myself? I entertain myself sinfully. There too I destroy myself. And there too am I not wronging myself. Let me go further. When I fall into immorality. He did not wrong only the girl, he also wronged himself. Why? Because he sinned. Because he offended the temple of God. And consequently, he wrongs himself by no longer being a temple of God. The Spirit of God rests upon man. But with sin, it will no longer rest upon him. Do you not, then, wrong yourself by depriving yourself of the presence of the Holy Spirit? You see, my beloved, that there is the matter of righteousness toward God, toward my neighbor, and toward myself. Indeed, some people feel at ease when they say, I wrong no one, I only wrong myself. And is that forgiven then, my brother, to wrong yourself? I do not think so. Besides, the measure for loving the other person is not your own self. Does not the law say, you shall love your neighbor as yourself? What is the measure? Your own self. So if you wrong yourself, and thus make yourself a measure of wrongdoing, will you not one day wrong your neighbor as well? Certainly. Therefore, here the apostle says, whatever things are righteous, think on these things. Whatever things are pure, whatever things are pure. Here he is now referring, as I told you earlier, to the motives behind modesty. Purity is not something restricted to the sphere of sins of the flesh. Somewhere, the apostle says to Timothy, keep yourself pure, that is, guard yourself and preserve yourself in purity. What does he mean by this? Does he mean that he must stay away from sexual acts, that is, from sins of the flesh? That is much too narrow. Purity is something very broad indeed. And it refers above all and chiefly to the motives and impulses of an action. What will move me toward righteousness? Purity. If I do not have purity of intentions, thoughts, and desires, then I will not move toward righteousness. So the motive power of every action, of every movement, is purity. In the broader sense, it means to be a pure person. How many times do we say this in our life? And of course, we do not mean someone who lives in virginity, or in purity in the bodily sense. We say, he is a pure person. We say it many times, a pure person. And this means a person who has good motives. Whatever things are lovely, whatever things are lovely. Literally, whatever things are beloved. Beloved by whom? Whatever things are beloved by God and by men. Yes, but among men sinful things are also beloved. Sinful things are beloved, too. Do you want to see that deep down, the very things people possess and love as worldliness? Deep down, they actually despise. Let me give you an example. You speak to a very worldly person. He has no idea. Or he does not want to have any idea of anything good in his life. You suggest to him that you enter into a partnership in something filthy. If that man is later asked about you by some third parties, he will not give good recommendations. Be sure of that. Even if he made use of you in a filthy partnership, he will not give good recommendations about you, if he speaks at all. On the other hand, if you said to him, my dear man, I do not agree with this filthy thing you want. And even if he goes so far as to accuse you, there will come a moment when third parties ask him, or at some unexpected time, perhaps many years later, do you know what he will say about you? That is a fine person. Deep down, even the wicked value what is good. If you wish, feel it out for yourselves and you will see it. This is why we would say that there are lovely things in the world, things worthy of love. What is their general name? Lovely. To be a courteous person. To be hospitable. Do not all people love these things? Tell me, do they not love them? Even the worst people love them. To be an honest person, a straight person, a person who is proper toward others in your dealings, all these things, and countless others, all this daily life. Listen, all this daily life, we live when it is rightly ordered. Who does not love it? God loves these things, and men love them too. So now the apostle says here, whatever things are lovely to God and to men, keep these things in your mind. When someone is ordained, whether a deacon or especially a priest, they say to him, may you live and be well-pleasing to God and to men. Have you heard this? What does it mean to be pleasing to God and to people? Is that perhaps a little contradictory? Because if I had to please people, to be pleasant in their eyes, would that mean I should give in to all their wishes? No, the blessing is rightly spoken. It is precisely, we might say, an echo of whatever things are lovely, Be careful, as though we were saying to the one who is about to exercise the ministry of holy orders, to whom we offer this blessing. Be careful not to clash with what is honorable, right, and serious, and so end up pleasing neither God nor men. This is what is lovely, what is beloved, how beautiful it is, truly, every word, anyone who loves its content, and has even a small taste of it. Do you know how he feels when he reads this passage? He is filled with enthusiasm, he finds himself inside it, and he feels the need never to depart from this wonderful realm of spiritual fruitfulness. Whatever things are of good report, whatever things have a good reputation. And here, what is the criterion of a good reputation? Sometimes we say, he is a proper gentleman. How many times do we say this? I remember once, and this is very old, I was a child. Yet some things have stayed with me because they made an impression. A child, a little girl, says to her mother, and I was present there too, I am going to find so, and so. Oh, my child, the mother says, do not spend too much time with that girl. Why? Mama, she is a good girl. She even wears a watch. Do you see the child's criterion? A good girl, she wears a watch. Today we say it differently. He is a respectable gentleman. He wears a tie, a suit, a bow tie, a fedora. I do not know what else, we say. A serious man. Listen, a serious gentleman. That is, if someone wore a flat cap or wore a pair of drill cloth trousers, would he cease to be respectable? Something like that. Well, no, beloved, certainly not. You see what our criteria are like. Sometimes we say, a fine priest. Why? He chants beautifully. And there it ends. Everything is finished there. So then, beloved, whatever things are of good report, whatever has a good reputation. Here again, we have the measure within ourselves, for there are good reputations, but they are not truly good reputations. Many times they smell of the world, of worldliness, and of something demonic. But we shall distinguish what truly has a good reputation. If we have within us the measure of piety, there are cases, beloved, where with complete lack of freedom, we would choose the opposite road. And what is this opposite road that we would choose? Listen to it. It is the anti-worldly road and the road of the cross. When you choose to live the spiritual life, you will receive mockery and therefore not things of good report. You know, this is exactly where our Christians stumble. One says, people will accuse me if they see me going to the church every Sunday or receiving Holy Communion every Sunday. So they will accuse you. Well then, what do you want? Do you want a good reputation, measured by worldly standards? And have you not distinguished good reputation according to the measure given by God and by piety? Do you see how things become confused here? Do you see that many times we have a mistaken understanding of what is of good report? That is, within ourselves, I will say it once more, as I said at the beginning, we have the measure of respectability. Oh, this respectability, my beloved. Let us put this respectability aside. Let us examine it again and see what this proper thing ought truly to be, and not as the world understands it. If there is any virtue, and if there is any praise, think on these things. If there is any virtue, or if anything is virtue, here again, the word virtue is a general name. He wants to say that all the things I have mentioned to you are virtues. All of them make up holiness. So then, because I could not exhaust the whole list of virtues, and so on. Now I speak generally. If there is any virtue, whatever is virtuous, whatever is noble, keep that in your mind. And if there is any praise, I would like to dwell on this expression of the apostle, if there is any praise. Here he means, in general, everything that is praised both by God and by human beings. And here we have the same case as with the things of good report. There are things that people praise, but God does not praise them. Did you hear that, please? What then will my criterion be? Where will the criterion be? The praise of God. And when the praise of men coincides with the praise of God, then of course I shall follow whatever is praiseworthy, if there is any praise. But this word gives me an occasion to say something. I do not know whether I shall stray a little from my subject, but since I have met this word, I would like to comment on it. As I told you, I am simply taking the occasion. It may not have very much to do with our main subject this evening. It is this. A mother was telling me something, and, besides, I told this mother that I would mention it in my talk, in Wednesday's talk. I do not know whether this mother is present. I do not know whether her relatives are. It does not matter. I will simply tell the incident, and I would be glad if her relatives passed it on to this mother, if they know the matter. After all, it is not something confidential. She has a little child, very small, perhaps 3 years old, somewhere around there, who 10 or 15 times a day will come up to his mother and say, "Tell me bravo, mama. Tell me bravo, mama." When I heard it, I became concerned. Here I want you to pay close attention. Perhaps at first glance someone would say, and would judge beforehand, that such a child in his life would want nothing other than to follow what the Apostle Paul says here, "If there is any praise." That is, I would like to do in my life whatever is praiseworthy. But is this exactly what is happening? Or is there here a delusion about the meaning of what is praiseworthy? Undoubtedly, there is a delusion. And the delusion is this: the person who seeks always to be told bravo is revealing beforehand, "My beloved," a terrible defect called vainglory or pride. And woe, woe, many times woe, if parents do not take care at this point and help their child not to seek bravo, because this child will become a slave of success and will acquire the complex of the excellent pupil or the excellent person. And he will not be able to face life, which has many failures, many stumbles, many difficulties, and many disappointments. Who, please, in his life has not known disappointment, difficulty, or failure, whether in the field of his work, or in life in general, or at school? Where? How? Woe to the child who always receives excellent marks. And many times, woe to the child when parents demand that their child receive excellent marks. It is terrible. We have a recent example. Even though I would be grieved to speak of it, a child committed suicide precisely for this reason. Precisely for this reason. Even when I was still a layman, I knew excellent students in elementary school, in high school. Standard bearers everywhere, always. As soon as they finished high school, they were afraid of life because they were afraid that there too, that is later at the university, they might not receive excellent marks. And what would their surroundings say if they did not receive excellent marks? I remember once a school teacher who was telling me about her son. I did not know the child himself. I knew only the mother. She told me that she always had a complaint about her son, that he was not the top student, and I said, "My goodness, what marks does your child have?" She said to me, 18, 19, but he is not the first, someone else is first. And once there was a celebration at the high school, and the other boy received the award, her son did not. And his mother came back bitter, angry, furious. She turned on her son. "Aren't you ashamed? Haven't you disgraced me? Why weren't you the one in first place?" And the boy, with meekness, a God, enlightened child, said to his mother, "Dear mother, is it not enough for you that I am a good student and received 18? Is that not enough for you? And now I say to the mother, I am sorry that you are also an educator, that you are also a teacher. Your child is wiser than you. So then, my beloved, I would like to beg you very much, help your children simply not to be lazy, but to be hardworking children. Sometimes a child will get 14, 13. Sometimes he will fall below the passing mark. You will say to your child, 'Pay attention, my child, struggle. It seems you are being a little lazy, struggle. Nothing more, study, nothing more.' Not, 'I want you to bring me a 20, so that afterwards dad can go out to the coffee house and say, my son came first, a fine thing. Fine, he came first. And so that mother can go out into the drawing rooms and say, my child came first. Of course, the example I am about to tell you is an extreme one. I myself suffered it, so I will tell it to you from my own experience. It was the time when the 8-year gymnasium was inaugurated, in 1937, so we had to go to the gymnasium after leaving the 4th grade of elementary school. Merely hearing the word gymnasium alarmed us. And the law, please note, had been issued in August, and in 1 month we would sit for examinations. Perhaps in less than a month, we were shaken. Imagine a child in the 4th grade of elementary school, only 10 years old, hearing that he would have to sit for examinations. We had never sat for examinations, because up to the 4th grade of elementary school, we did not have examinations. We were very much disturbed. My mother took care of things there. She would sit beside me, sewing, She would bring me a roasted chickpea, a dry crust of bread, coaxing me kindly. It was summer, and tell me, what is it like for a 10-year-old child to have to sit and study in the summer? It is against nature, anyway. She was wise in this respect. She coaxed me so that I would go and take the exams. I took the exams. The law said that they had to pass. They had to be accepted into the first year of the gymnasium. And that gymnasium, the gymnasium of a Mauritian, was a school that had jurisdiction. From Marusi all the way to the borders of Boeotia, Chalandri, Penteli, Menidi, Kefisia, Erythrea, all these places were served by one gymnasium for that whole large region. And the law said, they will take only 60 children. So there was competition, as you understand. At some point, in any case, we sat for the examinations, and I came somewhere around 20th, something out of the 60th. We listened to the results with great fear. I remember when they announced them to us there on the steps, the headmaster announced them. We were sitting like that, and it had grown a little dark. We walked back from Marusi to Kefisia, and I found my father in a shop. And I said to him, Father, I passed. And my father said to me, Good, sheer disappointment, sheer disappointment. I do not accuse my father. It was an extreme. I could have suffered the opposite of what a child suffers from too much. Bravo. But deep down, if you like, it benefited me, if you like. Because first of all, I did not make lessons or marks the purpose of my life. Besides, I always had low marks. Now how I passed there, I do not know why I passed. I do not know. In any case, the point is that I was not a good student. I say this sincerely. I am not saying it now so that you will tell me, well, now you must have been. No, I was not. I was a 14 out of 20 student. I say it without hesitation. A 14 out of 20 student through all my years. I hovered around there. I did not get 15. I did not get 15. So the point is this. My father did not strengthen this tendency toward praise. He could have said, Bravo, my child. To say, Bravo is an incentive. Listen to me. It is an important incentive. Not very often. Not very often. Therefore, we will praise. Just as I also praise in holy confession. Many times I praise, I tell you truly. When I see someone making progress, I only tell him, you know very well, do not let it go to your head, woe to you. But I will praise. It is an incentive that will help the other person struggle even more, because, to tell the truth, sometimes, a struggle in which we do not know how we are doing discourages us and wears us out. So too the teacher will praise at school. But take care, this, bravo, or the high mark, is a double-edged sword. And as I told you, in psychology, this is called the top student complex, and it requires great attention. We must teach our children sometimes to taste failure and disappointment, even in an artificial way, so that we may make strong people. It has been observed in one statistical study that students with 14, 15, 16, 17 out of 20 are more successful as scientists, as craftsmen, in whatever they have studied, than the students with perfect marks. This has been observed, it is known. Perhaps the educators will confirm me when they hear this. Grading is dangerous, and the worst thing is that our pedagogical system today, our educational system, forgive me today, for our children to advance into the higher schools, is this terrible thing, the competition of grades. The competition of grades. In other words, we make children who do not see knowledge before them, but the grade. And this is terrible, you will say to me, but the criterion must be the grade. What can I say? I am certainly not the competent person to solve the educational problem, and the proof that it is extremely difficult is that every quarter we change the system. Not every year, every 3 months. I no longer know. I cannot keep up. For a child to enter a school, what must he follow? How must he do it? Even the procedures are not known. So you see that our educational systems themselves strengthen and feed these destructive conditions. So I wanted to stay with this praise that the Apostle Paul speaks of here, telling you these things in order to help you know how you, too, can help your children and other people. We will say, well done, but with measure. We will say it when we judge it right and as much as we judge it right. And we will not hesitate also to scold our child and to point out to him that what he did is not good. And do you want to know something? If someone always says, well done, to me, I will begin to distrust him. I will say, when I succeeded in this, he told me, well done. When I did not succeed at something, he still told me, well done. So where, then, is the sincerity in this? When I know that the other person will correct me, will point out what is crooked, and will give me praise where something is straight, then I will say, there is sincerity here, and this is no small matter. But let me go on. The apostle says all these things. Think on these things. Keep them in your nous, your spiritual mind. Think on these things. That is, what does think on them mean? Let them work continually within you. Let them be something that begins from within you. Let them be the things that are your constant thoughts. How beautiful it is, truly, for the constant object of our thoughts to be how we may become people who are rightly placed in the eyes of God and in the eyes of men. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, do these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Which things? The things I told you just above. Which things? Whatever is true, whatever is righteous. These things which you both learned and received, and heard and saw, says the apostle. In me, pay attention here now, the apostle sets himself before them. Is this egotistical? Two other times he has said, become imitators of me, as I also am of Christ. It is not that. He simply wants to help the Philippians have a model for how they should move and conduct themselves. He himself says, I have Christ as my model, and you also must struggle to become models of Christ. When he says, you learned and received, he means, when I was with you and spoke to you, you saw my way of life. Did I perhaps stay with you for a month, and during that time force myself to give you a good example? And then, when I left, did I become someone different? So now you are learning bad things about me. No, you heard and you saw, not only what I was like when I was with you, but also what you heard about me, which means that I am always the same. So I would like to tell you, these things that I write to you, I beg you, since you received them from me, learned them from me, and saw them in me as things I live, do them yourselves. Do them yourselves. You may say to me, this is arrogance. For example, if I say to you, do you know, my beloved, why I am a monk? Because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. Is that arrogance? It is not arrogance. Because if I did not believe in the resurrection of the dead, you might say, will all who believe become clergy? No, I also have certain particular reasons. But, as we were saying, we Christians can all say this. Why do we deprive ourselves of certain things from this world, some pleasant things, or the pleasures of the world? Why do we deprive ourselves of them? Precisely because we believe in the resurrection of the dead. Or if we say this, is it arrogance? Is it pride? No. It is a demonstration that we believe, and that what I believe is true. So here too, when the apostle says that you should be the things I write to you, you have seen them in me. You cannot say, these are good, they are beautiful, but what does but mean? I live them. You too ought to live them. Why? Because these things are true. This is how you must live them. In other words, he tells them the necessity that they must live these things, because he himself lives them, and they should not be left with the doubt that, although they hear these things, the one who teaches them does not apply them. No, he believes them, he applies them, and he teaches them. That is why he says, whatever you saw in me, whatever you heard about me, whether I was present or absent, what you learned and what you received, do this. Do these same things. Practice these things. If I had to join these two verses together, verse 8 and verse 9, and take only their conclusions, we would say, think on these things. Do these things. Think these things. Practice these things. What things? What things? Whatever is the will of God. And the God of peace shall be with you. And the God of peace will be with you. This word, and, is the conclusion. We might say, now let me tell you the consequence as well. Now let me tell you the fruit. What is it? It is this. If you think on all these things and put them into practice, then the God of peace will be with you. He is called the God of peace, just as he is also called the God of patient endurance, just as he is also called the God of love. That is, the God who has love, the God who has peace, the God who has peace, the God who has patient endurance. That is why he is called the God of peace, because he is the one who has peace, and therefore he is the one who is the source of peace. It is not something that God simply gives you without possessing it himself. And when you have God, you already have the peace of God. Christ said, I give you my own peace. So if we receive this peace, of which he spoke to us in the previous theme we had, the peace, which surpasses all understanding, the one that surpasses every nous, every spiritual intellect, the incomprehensible, the ungraspable peace, which exceeds every understanding of man and angel. A peace that has no measure, no dimension, because this peace is of God. This peace, then, will be within you, because the God of peace will be with you. And the God of peace will be with you, because you will have kept his commandments. You will have taken care to draw near to him. You will have taken care to be united with him. And when you have been united with him, then the God of peace will be with you. Since the hour has now been completed, we will stop here. I believe that today I would finish the epistle to the Philippians. I am struggling to finish it, but I am not managing it. What is happening, and why can I not finish it? It is not hard to guess. From verse 11 to verse 20, he speaks about a personal matter of his own. As I was telling you last time, it is a personal matter. Historically, of course, it is personal, if we look at it as it is recorded in the epistle. But, my beloved, today journalists put their eye to the keyhole and look into people's bedroom life. What a shameful thing. What people occupy themselves with. What low things. They make these things their subject. Journalists often do. How poor they are. Truly poor. Going off with binoculars to see how someone bathes, how he dresses and undresses, to take photographs so they can have a large circulation. Because in the world, too, there is this sick curiosity to know another person's private life. But when we bend down to look at the private life of Paul, it concerns the matter of the money they brought him, the money they sent him, through Epaphroditus, the Philippians. And on that occasion, he now says thank you to them. He writes this wonderful epistle to the Philippians. There, my beloved. He writes to them about his own personal experiences. He says, "You did well to send this to me. But why did you send it? I have learned, in whatever state I am, to be content. I have learned to be a self-sufficient man. I have learned both to abound, and I have learned to be in need." These things are aspects of Paul's private life, but they can bear being made public. Not only can they bear it, they teach. Not only do they teach, they form a whole system for the upbringing of children and of people in general. Are these alone what save us? But could such a private life fail to stand up to public view? And could we not set it before people precisely so that we may become little Pauls ourselves? God willing, then. Next Wednesday, we will take up these secrets of Paul.